Today is a little different. We're going to discuss the history of Israel from Egypt to Canaan. We know that in many respects they went through experiences that are written for our benefit too. But you'll notice how the main difficulty with them was the lack of faith all the way through. And so in considering this subject, please keep in mind God's purpose for and with those whom he was dealing with at that time. The law constituted the basis on which the covenant with Israel was made, and it was designed not only to govern them morally, but to reveal to them by experience and to us by observation the exactitude and inflexibility of divine justice and righteousness. If we do not keep this in mind, we'll have little difficulty in understanding some of the things that take place. Obviously, the requirements of the law were far beyond the ability of the Israelites to achieve, even though they comprehended only the outward, the observable acts that could be punished, not the spiritual depths of meaning revealed by Jesus. Had Israel exercised faith, God would doubtless have bestowed upon them the grace and favor that he had promised, even though their works were imperfect. For in that event, they would have manifested a heart condition with which he was pleased, and their earthly blessings would have been abundant. But since faith was lacking, they hated his righteous requirements, and following their own fleshly desires, they disobeyed and were severely punished. In Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 to 10, Moses tells Israel that the Lord did not set his love upon them because of their worthiness or their numbers, but because he was bound by the oath that he made to their fathers. God's love is not an outgrowth of sentiment or feeling, as is generally the truth with mankind, but is the result of characteristics of benevolence, goodwill, kindness, mercy, and all like graces with which his love was motivated. Both the rewards and the punishments were essential to God's watch care over them, and both are evidences of his love. He did not set his love or his favor. We might think of it more from that standpoint with Israel there. He did not set his favor upon Israel because he approved them, but because he did approve the faith and obedience of their fathers, and because he is a beneficent God. Their foreknown sins of disobedience and idolatry were very displeasing to him. Nevertheless, he brought them out of Egypt and delivered them from bondage under Pharaoh, knowing, as Moses says, that the Lord thy God, he is God. the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations, and repayeth them that hate him to their face. He will not be slack to them that hate him, says Moses. The harshness of this statement seems strange to us who have been drawn by the Father in this gospel dispensation, this dispensation of grace. But we must remember that Israel was under a covenant that required obedience to the letter of the law in the flesh. Whereas we observe the spirit of the law in our hearts. And as Paul says in Philippians 3, verse 3, we are the circumcision which worship God in the spirit and rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. But if our hearts are sincere, we will not ignore the sinful desires of these fleshly bodies, but will strive earnestly to overcome them. Even though we know that our imperfections are not counted against us, there is therefore now no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus, we're told. For if we love God and his righteousness, we will endeavor to become like him. We who are striving to become fit for association with the Lord are being judged by our works which follow our justification, not the works that we did before, those were blotted out by God, but the works God judges our heart condition by our works since our justification. But why would Israel hate God? When time after time he demonstrated his power and willingness to protect them and to supply all their needs, even in the waterless, foodless, wilderness condition, why? The answer to this question lay within themselves. Faithfulness to God demanded that they exercise control over their fleshly desires, whereas the law in the flesh, as Paul speaks of it in Romans the 7th chapter, which since the fall of man is dominated by sin, insists on satisfying those desires. It was the pandering to fleshly desires of idol worship that was the downfall of Israel throughout much of her existence as a nation. And today we see this pandering rampant throughout all the world. Those in Israel who, through faith, were sincere of heart, did exceptionally well in their efforts to keep the law. There were some that had faith. Still, they died. For no one born in sin and shapen in iniquity could keep that law of God. But since a sincere effort in obedience to the divine requirements would in the very nature of things do a perfecting work upon their characters, and since their debt to justice was to be met by a substitute provided by God and was therefore as good as paid, he gave them promises of a better resurrection. Therefore, they are to come forth perfect, to act as princes in all the earth. the reward that is to be given to them is not that which the keeping of the law promised, which was an earthly inheritance and blessings. For in Hebrews 11, verses 13 to 16, it very clearly holds in reserve for them a heavenly hope. They pleased God because of their faith. They went through sufferings for their faith just the same as the church does today. And they trusted that he would reward their efforts in the doing of his will. The Lord's watch care over those who trust him is always alert, ever aware of their needs, and constant, and he never changes. In the periods of the judges and the kings which followed their wilderness experience, he often gave them victory over their foes, and temporarily they would turn toward him. At other times, they would need much affliction to change them. But when they had a leader that was inclined toward idol worship, they, as a nation, not the faithful ones, but they as a nation, would return to their idol worship. Consequently, Israel had a very checkered existence. But it was not until they rejected and killed their Messiah, who had come to instruct and redeem them, that all but a remnant lost the opportunity of becoming associated with the Messiah in the blessing of all mankind. It was following their humbling experience in Egypt that the many miracles were given to convince them that God was indeed their God. There were 10 miracles performed to liberate them from Egypt, and then 2 at the crossing of the Reed Sea, not the Red Sea. The arms of the Red Sea came up on both sides of the peninsula on which they were going through the wilderness. But it was the Reed Sea that was up there that they crossed first. And he performed these 2 miracles there to assure them of his continued protection. Their first test, however, was 3 days without water before reaching Lake Marah, there to find that its waters were too bitter to drink. They couldn't drink it. Now, here is where their complainings really started. They had complained when they found that the Egyptians were after them when they were camped before the Reed Sea. But here's where their complainings really started. And they asked Moses, "Just what are we supposed to drink?" Moses took the matter to the Lord and was shown a tree which, when cast into the waters, they were made sweet. This we know was picturing our Lord, really. Continuing on south through this wilderness of Etham first, they came to Elim, where they found 12 wells and 70 palm trees, truly an oasis in the desert. The numbers 12 and 70 seem to have some definite significance for Israel. When Jacob came into Egypt, he had 12 sons, and his household numbered 70. And when the nation was organized under Moses, under the law, there were the 12 tribes and the 70 elders. And then when Jesus organized his church, he chose first the 12 apostles and then the 70 evangelists. The 12 apostles were his chosen ambassadors for the teaching, the spirituality of his people. And the 70 would seem to represent the whole of those who proclaim the kingdom. At their second campsite in the wilderness of Sin, they left. They were going south, and they turned to east. And that was the wilderness of Sin. And their second campsite, they complained that he had brought them to where they had no flesh to eat, and that they would all starve to death. It's pretty hard to understand this, because their occupation when they were in Egypt was the raising of cattle and sheep and these animals. And when they left, they took them all with them. Pharaoh told them to take their animals. And here it was less than a month away, and they had no flesh, it says. And there's several instances throughout that shows that they had those cattle with them all the way. And when they came to the end, they had great herds of cattle, and yet they had no flesh to eat. And so they complained, and that they would starve to death. So that evening, God gave them quail by the thousands. And the next morning, he sent them the manna, the bread from heaven, which was precipitated with the dew of the night. From this time on, and for 40 years, they gathered an omer of manna per person every morning, except on Friday mornings, when they gathered two omers, one to be kept over for the Sabbath, for none fell on the Sabbath day. If they kept any of the omer that fell the other days, it spoiled, but this day it never spoiled, and that was all through the 40 years. This very unusual miracle fell no place but where the Israelites were camped. It must have been a perfect food too, for no one became sick during that 40 years, that is, from the average the sicknesses that people have. Many of them died because of their disobedience and the troubles that were brought upon them. But no one became sick. God could have served them food on a platter, no doubt. But they needed exercise. The kernels of manna were small and would melt under the hot sun. Consequently, they had to be up in the morning and gather it before the sun's rays became too direct and hot. So God thinks of everything. Their next encampment before Mount Sinai was at Rephidim, where God gave them an abundance of water. They complained they had no water. So God gave them her water out of the rock of Horeb, it is said, to quiet their complainings. It was here also that the nomad tribe of Amalek came down against them to kill and plunder, and were defeated by the army under Joshua. This was the way of life of these Amalekites, who did the same to David. They were a wandering tribe. They wandered around through Arabia and through desert land where the Jews were at this time. And you remember, they did the same thing to David and his 600 men. They came when they were away starting the war with the country that they were in at that time, the Philistines. They took their wives and their children and everything that they had. And when they got back, they were very much worried. And he took the matter to the Lord in prayer. You remember, and the Lord told him to go after them. And they got everything back and the things that belonged to others also. David had gone there to escape being killed by Saul. On the first day of the third month after leaving Egypt, that would be just 2 months of time had passed, they camped at Sinai. And in obedience to God's command, Moses sanctified them on the first and second days, instructing them to cleanse themselves and to refrain from indulgences. For on the third day, God would manifest himself to them by fearful sights and sounds on Mount Sinai, at which time he gave them the law and made with them the covenant to which they agreed. The covenant was ratified by the blood of sacrifice of goats and bulls. They had the goats and bulls for the sacrifice. And they sprinkled them and the book of the law. All the things that Israel experienced from Egypt to Canaan seem to have been typical and are recorded for our admonition by Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 to 12. The things that occurred on that third day are cited in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 to 29. As typical of what would take place at the opening of the new dispensation when Christ takes over his kingdom. The tabernacle built in accord with explicit instructions from God was finished and set up and dedicated the first day of the first month of the second year of their Exodus. So they had been away from Egypt just 1 year. Then on the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud that hovered above the tabernacle, which had followed them all the way from Egypt, lifted and led the way to Taberah. Every place that they camped, they were led there by God through that cloud. That was their first stop on the way to Kadesh Barnea. Consequently, Israel had been in Sinai 11 months and 20 days, during which time they had received the law and the covenant made with them, and had been inducted into the ritual of the tabernacle service. At Taberah, their complaints and their criticisms of the Lord were punished by a fire sent in their midst by God that destroyed many of them. Numbers 11, verses 1 to 3 speak of this. It was here also that the mixed multitude that had come out of Egypt with them lusted for flesh. They had sickened of the manna, and they wanted flesh to eat. So God, a second time, sent them many quail, and they had flesh to eat for just a month, resulting in a plague from the Lord that destroyed many of them. It was also in this connection, before they had received the quail, that Moses became discouraged and complained. You didn't find much complaint from Moses, but here he became discouraged, complained, and he asked of the Lord, "Why hast thou afflicted me, and wherein have I found disfavor, in that thou hast placed the burden of all this unruly people on me? Did I beget them, that I should have to carry them in my bosom? I am not able to carry them alone." And so the Lord told him to select 70 of the elders of Israel, that he would put his spirit upon them, and they would bear the burden with him. Then at Hazeroth, the next campsite, which was in the terrible wilderness of Paran, as Moses calls it, Miriam and Aaron criticized Moses because of his Ethiopian wife. Evidently, it was Miriam that instigated this criticism, for she was the one whom God afflicted with leprosy and banished from the camp for 7 days, and then healed her in answer to the prayer of Moses. And you note all the way through this experience, they never prayed to the Lord themselves. It was always Moses they went to intercede for them. There were several camps in this terrible wilderness of Paran before reaching Kadesh Barnea, and the last one was evidently located near this point. For it was from here that God instructed Moses to send spies to reconnoiter the land and report the best way to invade and take possession of it. And this was approaching the end of the 2 years. But contrary to their commission, when after 40 days, the 12 spies returned who were sent. 10 of those spies advised against God's instructions, saying, "The people there are taller than we are. The giants are there, the sons of Anak, and their cities are surrounded by high, impregnable walls. We were just grasshoppers in our own eyes and in theirs." So, for the past 2 years, Israel had been given abundant evidence of God's power and watch care over them. But as the account shows, they were still unbelieving and unwilling. Their lack of faith was part of the lack of willingness to exercise faith. Faith is a volition of our own. And we must be willing to exercise faith, for one thing. We ourselves have found at times, no doubt, that to go, faith means that we must go directly contrary to all the inclinations of the fleshly mind. When we are confronted with some decision of life where we have only faith in God to back us up. Some mistakenly place all the responsibility for the having a faith on God by their misunderstanding, as I would take it at least, of what Paul says in Ephesians 2, verse 8. Faith as a believing operation is not a free gift from God. For if that were true, then God would have been very unjust to condemn the people of Israel for their lack of faith. If he hadn't given it to them, then he would be responsible for the fact that they didn't have faith. Ephesians 2, verse 8 in Ephesians 2, the subject of that verse is salvation, not faith. Salvation is the gift of God. Several times in Romans, he speaks of that being a free gift of God, but in response to faith. Faith is the volition of our own minds, our own wills, not something that we do apart from our own determination. The Israelites were completely upset by the report of the spies, and many were in favor of appointing a captain to take them back to Egypt at once. This caused Moses and Aaron to fall on their faces, and Caleb and Joshua rent their garments and urged the people to obey God, assuring them that he would be with them to give them possession of the land. But they would not believe, and they would have stoned Caleb and Joshua had not the glory of the Lord appeared at the tabernacle with his voice saying to Moses, "How long will this people provoke me? And how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have shown among them? I will smite them with pestilence and disinherit them, and will make of thee a greater nation and mightier than they." But, in my opinion at least, this last statement of God was largely a testing of Moses himself. But Moses met that test wonderfully by pleading for Israel and for the fulfillment of the divine promise made to Abraham and the manifestation of the divine glory in the fulfilling of that promise. This time, however, their rebellion against God was to be serious. For instead of 2 years of wilderness experience, God decreed for them 40 years, in order that all who had been 20 years of age or more might die in the wilderness in accordance with the wish that they had expressed in Numbers 14:2, that they wished they had died in the wilderness. And so God said they would have their wish. "For as truly as I live, saith the Lord, as ye have spoken in mine ears, so will I do to you. Tomorrow, turn you and get you into the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. But prior to this, before he said this to them, these things took place, and before the return of the spies, Moses, for the second time, brought water from the rock to quiet the complaints of Israel. And here is where Moses and Aaron were told by God that they had not honored him in performing this miracle of the water of Meribah, and so would not be permitted to enter Canaan with Israel. Moses said he was vexed with the people himself, and he said, "Must I bring water from this rock for you rebels?" And so he did not honor God in that and was not permitted to enter Canaan. Then, too, Miriam, who was older than Moses and Aaron, died here before the return of the spies. You remember, she was the girl sent out when Moses was put amongst the rushes, when in Egypt the children had to be, male children had to be killed. It is difficult to locate as to time and place some of the events that followed the return and destruction of the 10 spies. Except that Israel is now told that they must remain in that wilderness 38 more years. And to assist their memory of the covenant that they had made, the Lord tells them to sew a fringe on the borders of their garments, that whenever they observe that fringe, it will bring to their remembrance the commandments of the Lord to do them. Then, apparently, still while at Kadesh Barnea, there occurs the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, with 250 princes of the congregation who gather before Moses and Aaron and accuse them of usurping their authority and leadership. Moses humbles himself before God, and he says to them, "Tomorrow the Lord will show who is he is and who is holy, and will cause them to come near unto him. This do," this is in number 16, "take you censers and put fire therein. Then add incense and appear before the Lord. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy," or he shall be the one sanctified. "You take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi," says Moses. "It is no small thing that you do the service of the tabernacle and minister unto the congregation. And seek ye now the priesthood also? Ye are gathered against the Lord, not against Aaron. For what is Aaron that ye murmur against him?" Dathan and Abiram refused to come before Moses, saying that he had taken Israel out of a good land and had brought them into the wilderness in order to make himself a prince over them. The next day, the 250 princes and Aaron stood with their censers at the door of the tabernacle. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them. And the glory of the Lord appeared unto them, and God said to Moses and to Aaron, "Separate yourselves from the congregation, and I will consume them all in a moment." This is the second time God had threatened to do this. But Moses and Aaron fell on their faces and pleaded for the congregation, saying that Korah and those with him were alone responsible. Then at God's behest, Moses tells the congregation to separate themselves from Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses says to the people, "If these men die the common death of all men, then the Lord hath not sent me. But if the Lord make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth and swallow them all with all that pertains to them, then ye shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord." And as he finished, the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them, their houses, and all their goods. And the people fled, lest they also perish. And fire came out from the Lord in the tabernacle and consumed the 250 princes. And then, the next day, although it would seem almost incredible, the whole congregation came and blamed Moses and Aaron for the death of those people swallowed by the earth and consumed by the fire from the Lord. And again the Lord says to Moses and Aaron, "Separate yourselves from the congregation, that I may consume them." But again they intercede. And Aaron hastens and makes an atonement for them, and the plague which had already begun was stayed, so that only 14,700 of them died, beside those who perished with Korah. Following this, there is no detailed account concerning Israel for those next 38 years. Following this, there is no detailed account concerning Israel for those next 38 years. You don't know where they went in the wilderness. The names of their camps are given in the 33rd chapter, but nobody knows where they were, and they were doubtless just names of the camp that they had given them. And so those years were spent in the wilderness, and just where and how is not revealed. It is said in Deuteronomy 1:46 that they remained in Kadesh Barnea many days. Then, as the 40th year begins, they come to light in Kadesh Barnea. And in Deuteronomy 2, verse 14, it reveals that the space in which they had come from Kadesh Barnea until they were come over the brook Zered was 38 years. Numbers 20, verse 13, tells of the things that happened at the end of the second year, brings up to the happenings of that year. Then verse 14, without any intimation otherwise, resumes with the things occurring in the beginning of the 40th year. So there's 38 years of space between those two verses. Israel had returned from the wilderness to Kadesh Barnea by the 40th year, for Moses wrote from here asking the king of Edom for permission to cross Edom by the king's highway. He must have felt certain of a favorable answer, for we next find Israel at Ezion Geber, which was at the head of the eastern arm of the Red Sea that came up on that side of the peninsula, and where the highway crosses into Eden. But Moses' request was not granted. And being warned of God not to molest Edom, Moab, or Ammon, they were descendants of Abraham, you know, by Esau and by Lot, they retrace their steps and go to Mount Hor, where, at God's command, Moses, Aaron, and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, in line to become the high priest, ascend the mount in the sight of all the people. And Moses strips Aaron of his robes of office and puts them on Eleazar, and Aaron dies there at the age of 123. Israel had now come to the last short portion of her wilderness journey. The end was still several months away, as a number of things had to happen in that time. The plains of Moab, where they would spend quite a bit of that time, was still the eighth encampment away. Here was also where they would cross the Jordan into Canaan eventually. The country through which they had to pass was still wilderness. Its nature is revealed by the circuitous route of more than 50 miles required to reach Oboth, which was only about 12 miles from Mount Hor. The length of their stay at the plains of Moab is not revealed. But during that time, they met and destroyed Sihon, king of the Amorites, and all of the people of that country, that nation, man, woman, and child. And then they went on and met Og, the king of Bashan, who was the last of the giants there. It tells about his bed being 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. So he must have been pretty big. But they killed him and all of the men, women, and children. And the lands that they took were allotted to the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. But they were on the east side of the Jordan. They were not in Canaan. But they had come to Moses and asked to have them because they had great flock of cattle and sheep. And they wanted those lands were fit for that. And so they had those all the way through, and yet they had no flesh. So it's pretty hard to understand just what that all means. Moses also sent an army of 12,000 men that completely destroyed Midian. its five kings, its cities, homes, and people. They had thought to save the women and children, but Moses made them destroy all but the girls who were too young to marry. It was also during this time, when Israel was encamped on their border, that Balak, king of Moab, tried to hire Balaam to curse Israel. You'll find this account in Numbers 22, 23, and 24, those chapters. How this Midianite soothsayer and seer could seek and obtain instructions from God, we don't know. But he did, and his final answer to Balak, recorded in Numbers 24, verses 3 to 9, is beautifully expressed. Then, too, it was seemingly a suggestion that he made to Balak that caused the women of Moab to lure thousands of the men of Israel to join in their licentious religious rites, which brought about a plague from the Lord that killed 24,000 of the men. Now this brings us up to a culmination in the life of Moses. Deuteronomy chapters 30 to 34 give God's final instructions that end the oversight of Moses for Israel. Verses 1 to 16 of chapter 30 give promise of blessings that would come to them if they would truly seek to serve the Lord when their Messiah came to reign. But verses 17 to 20 constitute a definite warning, which they did not heed. In chapter 31, verses 1 to 15, Moses tries to fortify and encourage them. But in verses 16 to 18, God tells him what is to happen to Israel after he is gone. Then in verse 19, God tells Moses to write a song or a poem that was to be learned by Israel, that they might keep in mind his workings with them. And in chapter 32, Moses and Hoshea, that was the name of Joshua, recite the poem to Israel. And in chapter 33, Moses invokes his blessing on each one of the tribes. And in chapter 34, as God instructed in chapter 32, Moses ascends Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, where God shows him all the land of Canaan that he would give to Israel. And he said, I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of God, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And the angels of God buried him in a valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor. But no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. And Moses was 120 years old. His eye was not dim, nor was his natural force abated. And there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. I feel sure that with me you can picture the form of Moses standing at the brow of Nebo's height, still erect, energetic, waiting for the touch of death from God. And we close with a poem. The writer is unknown, but it has to do with this experience. On Nebo's lonely mountain height, on the east side Jordan's wave, in a vale in the land of Moab, there lies a lonely grave. And no man knows that resting place, no man did e'en draw near, for the angels of God upturned the sod and laid the dead man there. That was the strangest funeral rite that ever took place on earth, but no man was there to view it or to see the train go forth noiselessly, just as the day dawns when the night is o'er and gone, and the crimson streak on ocean's cheek grow into the great white sun. God has his mysteries of grace, ways that we cannot tell. He hides them deep like the hidden sleep of him he loves so well.
Below all love. city of peace, where the God of all grace I shall see. That the glorious strains which the ransomed shall see in that heavenly kingdom shall be. Peace, wonderful peace, precious gift from the Father of all. Sweep over my soul.